Well, I think when we imagined having these couple weeks introduction to amplitudes in this overlap period, I guess the sort of imagined sort of state of people's emotional states vis-a-vis the LHC wasn't as obvious as it is now. And in particular, it's I think in some ways not as good a time to imagine doing it as it might have been. I mean, had things been more boring, it would be easier not to be nervous and twitchy, and actually focus on learning something you know, deep and exciting and new. As it is, of course. Certainly, all of you in the LHC program, along with me, have been on a more than the usual emotional roller coaster in the past 6 months, with all the various anomalies, the Higgs discovered, not discovered, WJET-JET, TT bar asymmetry, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever the heck is going on at CMS right now that no one's telling us about. So understandably, everyone is very excited. Everyone is waiting to see what's coming out of this machine that we've waited, some of us 30 years, some of us 20 years, some of us 15 years, but a long, long, long time for. So in that sense, it is it's not a particularly quiet time. And so it's not perfectly ideal to introduce, well, or if you haven't thought about any of these things before, to start thinking about them. But nonetheless, I'm still going to try to convince you and tell you something about why I think, and I must say, I say this as certainly a relative newcomer to the subject, but the subject of the physics of scattering amplitudes and gauge theories and gravity is an absolutely stunning, spectacular subject. No matter what happens at the LHC, whether it's spectacularly exciting, if it's a spectacular dud, independent of that, there's something just absolutely magical and extraordinary going on, the structure of physics that we know for a fact describes the world. This is not speculative physics. This is physics that we know for a fact. We've known for 60 years that gauge theories describe the world. We've known for longer than that that GR describes gravity at low energies. And yet we're discovering stupendous mathematical structures governing the actual answers that come out of the calculations that are completely hidden in the usual way we have of talking about things. And understanding them promises something big. It promises, we're not there, but I think we're on the road to going there. It promises a transformation in our understanding of quantum field theory, a transformation in our understanding of space-time and quantum mechanics. And there's a road to getting there, which is not fraught with obstacles and difficulty. There's a true path. You just, if you learn how to calculate better, if you know things are going well when you can calculate things that last year seemed completely ridiculous to calculate. And that seems to be happening in this field at a remarkable pace over the past 15 years, 10 years, more and more happening as sort of more and more people enter the subject. But I don't want to make any bones about it. I mean, I think the bottom line payoff of the potential payoff of this sort of investigation could be absolutely gigantic. It could change the way we think about very fundamental things. It could be that when all is said and done, the very names that go into quantum field theory will have to be rethought, and what quantum field theory is will really be seen to be something completely different. So, and actually, by way of one more motivation, especially for those of us in the on the LHC part of the program, I think this used to be a kind of cartoon. This is exciting. And this is, you know, hard, important to do, which are nice ways of saying important to do, but sort of basically boring. Someone needs to do it so that we can extract the exciting things out of the huge background. And I think it is one of the lovely ironies of the subject, but a good example of how physics doesn't leave good deeds unrewarded, that this morally correct activity, which was justified, really largely motivated for many, many years by the desire to do calculations for Hadron Collider physics. It's the people doing these heroic, remarkable calculations for 25, 20, 15 years that started uncovering an absolutely spectacular structure in the answer that were totally unexpected from Feynman diagrams. And I think ultimately, just repeating what I said, pursuing that line, even though it was motivated by extracting, you know, the one squark per minute that we might make at the LHC out of the hundreds of thousands of times a second we make two gluons to four gluons, that really sitting in here was the heart of something really remarkable in our understanding of basic physics. And the final little sort of historical analogy I'd like to make, again along the same lines, is that of course physics has very often progressed by new discoveries at the experimental frontiers, and that's the most time-honored way, the one sort of guaranteed way to make progress. But in certain sort of dramatic moments, progress has happened in other ways. Einstein wasn't paying attention to the very, very latest experimental discovery made with the latest whiz-bang gadgets of his time. He was thinking about the structure of laws that had been understood in some cases for 50 years, in some cases for 200 years, and seeing that there was something in them, there's something remarkable in them that needed to be reconciled and understood. It was clues sitting under his nose, sitting under everyone's noses. And I think time will tell if it's going to be of comparable significance. But there are, again, clues sitting under our noses, just in standard physics, not necessarily at the frontier of experimental discovery, but just in the structure of good old-fashioned physics that seems to suggest something remarkable and new at play. And I should say that to anyone with a more formal bent, everyone knows that our understanding of quantum field theory at least underwent its most recent revolution starting around 20 years ago with the beginning of the understanding of what happens with field theory at strong coupling. So we didn't know what field theories did at strong coupling. And then we found out that they amazingly were dual to other theories. Or even more amazingly, they were dual to theories of quantum gravity in one higher dimension. These are absolutely astonishing facts about things that quantum field theory could do that are not obvious in the Lagrangian, but which are facts about what happens when you solve the system. But it's also fair to say that all those amazing things that were happening in the place where we didn't know what was going on anyway. There'd be monsters, and well, instead of monsters, it's a theory of quantum gravity in one higher dimension. Of course, there have been hints the whole time, the existence of theories without any sort of Lagrangian description at all, like the 2,0 theory. There's an example of just an absolute classic challenge to a theorist. Here's a theory, there's no Lagrangian, it exists. How do you talk about it? So we haven't known what to do about that problem for a long time. But it's another example of something where the mysteries are buried at strong coupling. What's really interesting about the scattering amplitude business, I mean, there's lots of fantastically interesting things at strong coupling, but the delicious surprise is that there's something sitting there at weak coupling. There's something sitting there in the part of the problem that Feynman in principle solved 60 years ago, which hints that radically new mathematical structures at work with already starting to see, as I mentioned a number of times, some new picture for where the answers come from, which does not put in by hand the usual ingredients of a Lagrangian and a path integral, the usual ingredients of locality and unitarity, but gets the answer from somewhere else and has those features emerge as a property of the answer. So in a very controlled, concrete way, we're starting to understand where these building blocks come from that allow us to build local unitary evolution out of more primitive ingredients. And as I mentioned, it has been an absolutely amazing period for 15 years, 10 years, 5 years. There's lots and lots going on. Tremendous progress. But something I'd like to stress to the people who are not working in this subject is that there are some impressions. Certainly, I had the impression this is an extremely technical subject. It's lots and lots of very tough work, and there is some tough work, but it's more wide open than certainly any other subject I've worked in. There's a vast number of completely open directions, totally unsolved problems. Most of the progress has been made for many obvious reasons, for maximally supersymmetric theories. There is just absolutely wide open zeroth order problems that you just have to sort of walk down the street and run into and start making progress on. The problem is that there's a factor of 10 more interesting problems than there are people in the field to work on them. And finally, to the model builders in the audience, and now then I'll get going with the content. I found the subject perfect for the model builder's temperament, because that's what it is, you know. So there's a massive amount. You actually get to have the sort of fantasy of what you wanted with interacting with experimental data. It's just the experimental data is all theoretical, but people have computed scattering amplitudes for 60 years. There's incredible patterns lying around in what people have computed already. So there's patterns there. You should understand where the patterns are coming from. The data exists. You can look at it. You can play with it. You can come up with intermediate explanations for what's going on. You can try to come up with top-down explanations. You can try to, if you're not happy with the data that exists, you can go collect more data yourself. You know, you just have to put your back into it. You don't have to ask for billions of dollars. You just have to. It may be, you know, some small fraction of that for a couple of grad students, but it's really possible to it's possible to generate data, look at patterns, and try to understand what's going on at several different levels, and it's an enormous amount of fun. Okay, so with those motivations aside, the purpose of these lectures. Or these two lectures that I'm giving, isn't so much to give a big overview of all the recent results and all that stuff. If you want things like that, or if you're interested in things like that, there have been a couple of talks of that, kind of that variety, just in the scattering amplitude program. Mark Spradlin gave a wonderful introductory talk, which is online and which I encourage you to look at for sort of an update of where things are, at least where things were as of a month and a half ago. Instead, what I want to do is actually tell you, at least from my perspective, the things you actually need to know to work in this subject. Okay? There's not that many things, and so I think it's possible to cover in the limited time that I have. So. That was meant to be a joke, all right. So what I'm going to focus on today is kinematics. Okay. And I just want to tell you about the basic language, variables, symmetries, and so on that we use to talk about scattering amplitudes. All right. So. The usual way we think about scattering amplitudes, first of all, what is a scattering amplitude? Well, let's say we're in four dimensions. Scattering amplitude is a function of, I'm going to imagine that all the momenta are incoming. So momentum conservation It's just a statement that the sum of all the PIs is equal to zero. To be consistent, my particle label is always going to be A. A will run from 1 to N. And so this is really what the amplitude is. It's a function of the helicities. Let's say the particles are massless. It's a function of the helicities of the particles and a function of the momenta. That means that it has a very specific transformation law under Lorentz transformations, right? If I do a Lorentz transformation, M of lambda P1, lambda Pn, H1 up to Hn, this is not invariant. Instead, what I get is the corresponding phase rotation associated with the little group element associated with that Lorentz transformation on each. So just group theoretically, this is what an amplitude is. If someone hands you an amplitude and claims that it's an amplitude, one first check that you should do to see, does it transform correctly under Lorentz transformations? And this is what it has to do when it transforms under Lorentz transformations. Now, this is the first most basic reason why we don't normally see honest-to-goodness scattering amplitudes in introductory quantum field theory courses. Because we almost never write this object down. We almost never write this object down explicitly. Okay? What the amplitude is really explicitly is a function of the helicities of the particles and as a function of the momenta. Okay? What we normally write down, what we compute from Feynman diagrams, are, let's say we have spin one particles. What we compute from Feynman diagrams are Feynman amplitudes, which have, if I have a spin one particle, have Lorentz indices, single Lorentz index. Spin two would have two Lorentz indices. And then we say, to get the actual amplitude, we then dot this into polarization vectors. So this already is a funny act, because the different helicity amplitudes are actually different. They have very different physical behaviors. And yet, what we compute with Feynman diagrams actually completely erases all of those distinctions. Okay? We compute exactly the same m mu 1 up to mu n, no matter what process we're talking about. And only at the very end of the day do we put in the physical information about what the helicities are into what those polarization vectors are. Okay, that's fine. And really, sort of said pedantically, we imagine that there is such a thing as a polarization vector, which is like a bifundamental under Lorentz transformations and little group transformations. It should have the property that when you do a Lorentz transformation on the polarization vector, the mu index transforms with lambda, and it's multiplied by the phase factor on the left corresponding to its little group rotation. All right, that's what we do. Now, before we spend a lot of time crapping all over them, let's remind ourselves what it is that Feynman diagrams are designed to do. The whole point, I mean, what made Feynman famous was that by representing the scattering as a process in space-time using his diagrams, we can make essentially unitarity and locality manifest at the same time in our description of the scattering process. We know that's challenging because of the standard facts that quantum mechanics has a preferred time. Well, quantum mechanics needs to talk about time evolution in some frame. Relativity doesn't like to have preferred frames, and so in the usual way of doing things. Before Feynman, people couldn't keep both locality and unitarity manifest at the same time, but the diagrams help you keep locality and unitarity manifest at the same time. That's their point in life, okay? So Feynman diagrams makes locality and unitarity manifest. As manifest as they can be. And as we know very well, that, as manifest as they can be, starts getting interesting when we have particles of high spin, particles of massless particles of spin one and higher. And the essential difficulty is that we have, for example, well, for any massless particle in four dimensions, we have two helicity states, H equals plus or minus S, S is the spin of the particle. But this thing that we did up there to actually compute the actual amplitude, the thing with the correct transformation properties, the thing that's the physical amplitude, this invocation of these polarization vectors is a complete fiction. There is no such thing as the polarization vector for massless particles of spin one and higher. It's a basic counting problem that we need two polarization vectors. But again, said pedantically, this is a consequence of unitarity. So unitary representations of the Poincaré group are labeled by helicity, so that's why we have two states. Locality comes in our desire to describe this physics using fields, so that we can write down local interactions between the fields. But if we write, if we have an A mu and we write a polarization vector, we write a plane wave solution like that, there are four epsilons, because there are four A's, there's only two physical helicity components. We can try to put constraints on epsilon, like epsilon dot P equals zero, but that doesn't do it. That still leaves us with 3 degrees of freedom. And so what we're forced to do, we're forced, by locality and unitarity, we're forced to introduce redundancy, to introduce gauge redundancy. We're forced to say that we are to identify epsilon and epsilon plus anything times p in order to finally remove that, to finally talk about 2 degrees of freedom. This is a real novelty, right? It's a real novelty. Before, in the discussion of quantum mechanics, no one needed to introduce redundant parts of the Hilbert space in order to describe what's going on. But to keep locality, and we don't either if we're happy to not have manifest locality or manifest unitarity, but if we want to have both of them manifest, the price is that we have to introduce all of this redundancy. Okay. And this redundancy is, of course, what's back in position space. It's just the normal gauge redundancy. So we have a little bit of redundancy for gauge theory, from 4 to 2 degrees of freedom. We have a massive amount of redundancy in gravity, to go from the 10 degrees of freedom of h mu nu down to the 2 physical degrees of freedom of the graviton. This is the gauge redundancy. That's the diffeomorphism redundancy. By now, this is so well known in our subject that we don't need to hammer it home again and again. But it's worth saying one more time, this gauge symmetry is a complete farce. It doesn't exist. It's all in our head. It's a redundancy that's useful to describe the physics, and that's all. It's not a property, it's not an invariant property of the system. It's a property of the language we choose to describe it with. Okay? Now, the sort of traditional attitude is, was for a long time, yes, this is a stunningly fantastic language with which to describe the physics. And it certainly beat what the people had in the 1930s. Okay? And indeed, you can use Feynman diagrams to compute 2-to-2 scattering processes, beautifully get the answers in one line that took other people 6 months to compute, and so on. But it was when people, for practical reasons, needed to start computing more complicated processes that the essential nub, that the essential the pain of all of this structure first starts showing up. So an example probably many of you have seen, if any of you have seen any talk of Zwies, many of you have seen it. But let's just talk about one which is fun. Let's say we do 2-to-4 gluon scattering. again, this is a dominant background to Galeno pear production at the LHC. I won't bother being too detailed about it yet. But if you just write down all the tree diagrams, there's 220 Feynman diagrams. It depends how you count, but there's tens of thousands of terms. There's like 20, 30, 40 pages of terms, okay? Ridiculous number of terms. And that's because there's a zillion combinatorial ways we can glue together the 3 and 4 point vertices, and the 3 and 4 point vertices are a little bit complicated, and there's FABCs everywhere. If you strip off the color factors, it's not that much fun. And that's the point. These are all the different ways the thing could have happened in space-time, and it's all guaranteed. The probability is going to add up to one. That's it. That's as well as we're going to do. But if you actually need the answer, that doesn't suffice. Now, many of you, I'm sure, know that Park and Taylor made a sort of real breakthrough here in the late 80s by finding a one-term expression for this object. In the particular case where, let's say, two of these helicities are minus and the rest of them are plus, let me put it here. Park and Taylor wrote down this formula, and we'll talk about the notation in a bit, but this stunning one-line answer that sums all of these 220 Feynman diagrams together, at least for that helicity configuration. What most people don't know, actually I didn't know until I went back and looked at the literature, is that before this paper, Park and Taylor had another remarkable breakthrough paper where they succeeded in writing this answer down in only 8 pages. Okay, and you know, because if you do it the normal way, it's 50 pages. They managed to write it down only 8 pages using the Schnasius techniques, using n equals 2 supersymmetry to relate this answer to another process involving Galenos and doing all the fanciest tricks. They managed to reduce it to 8 pages. And they said at the end of their paper that they hoped to simplify this further so that it would be not only an experimentalist but also a theorist's delight. And that's what they proceeded to do. Okay. So these things were not obvious. Okay. There's an immediate generalization of this formula that was then proven using the techniques of Behrens and Hilliard recursion relations and other things later. There's lots of activity in the late 80s and early 90s and starting to see some of this stunning structure. But this should convince you there's something terribly, terribly wrong with the standard way of doing things. Now, it turns out that the most general helicity configuration with 3 pluses and 3 minuses was also worked out in a little later in the 90s, and is expressed in even more beautiful and compact notation using the BCFW recursion relations that Ruth will talk about tomorrow, and is expressed in terms of 3 terms. So this isn't some sort of accident. I mean, you might think. Certainly, as an outsider to the subject for a long time, I thought all of this magic about these amplitudes with 2 negative and many positive helicity gluons was really because these things were very, very close to the self-dual sector of Yang-Mills theory. Self-dual sector of Yang-Mills theory is integrable, it's simple, it's nice. Maybe the things that are really close to being self-dual are incredibly simple, but everything else is a horrible mess. Okay? Well, that's not true. You know, these amplitudes, in fact, all amplitudes in supersymmetric theories, as we understand now, are controlled by some structure. There's nothing so overtly to do with the integrability of the self-dual sector of the theory or anything like that. So why is it that the answer is incredibly simple while Feynman diagrams are incredibly complicated? Is it some technical minutiae of the way the diagrams are computed? No, No, it's really the heart and soul of what Feynman diagrams do. They make locality unitarity manifest that needs all of this gigantic amount of gauge redundancy. And it's all that gigantic amount of gauge redundancy that's hiding the simplicity of the answer. Okay? That answer, if you just wrote it down, well, in this case, it's relatively simple to check that it actually does satisfy unitarity and locality. But more generally, if it's not being, there is a suggestion that the answer is being produced by some machine which doesn't much care about locality or unitarity. It cares about some other principles, but it gets the answer right away. Write down the answer. And then an observed property of the answer are these properties like locality and unitarity. Okay? And that's just that's an astonishingly exciting clue for something to pursue within the structure of gauge theories, and a place where we can compute. You know, as I said, all the data is there for the taking. All right. So that's a sort of overarching theme, is to try to describe the physics as much as possible invariantly, and try to get the answers. Try to see what structures govern the answer, and as we'll see, there really seems to be some new and very, very interesting mathematical structure governing the structure of the answer, from which locality and unitarity are derived consequences. Okay, so that's the review of the usual way of doing things. So let's now start talking about the kinematics properly, and begin the road to describing this physics as sort of invariantly as possible. And a big theme of this entire lecture is to trivialize as much as possible kinematics, symmetries, all of the sort of most trivial universal properties of the amplitudes. We want to make as simple as possible so that we're not tripping over our shoelaces all the time in order to see the actual structure that's trying to shine through out of it. Okay? Okay. So let's begin by talking about the amplitudes again. So in textbooks, we think about the amplitude as a function of momenta and polarization vectors. But as we've seen, that's a very redundant way of talking about it. What we'd like is a way of directly talking about the amplitudes. We really want to directly write down objects which have the correct Lorentz transformation properties. Okay? That's not functions of polarization vectors and momenta. You would think that this is a problem that should have been answered in chapter one of Weinberg. You know, what are amplitudes functions of in a general quantum field theory? As of today, the answer to this question in a completely general theory in any number of dimensions isn't known explicitly. I think many people sort of know it. But it's an very interesting sort of group theory problem about Poincaré in any number of dimensions. But happily, in four dimensions, the answer is very well known, and it's extremely simple. And the answer is that the amplitudes are not functions of polarization vectors and momenta. Instead, they're functions of spinner helicity variables. So often, spinner helicity variables are introduced as kind of a trick. And indeed, that's how they were first discussed as a very useful trick for simplifying Feynman diagram calculations. But really, fundamentally, amplitudes in four dimensions are functions of spinner helicity variables directly, not redundantly, just directly functions of spinner helicity variables. And that's what's important about them. So to review the basic construction, suppose someone hands you a massless four vector. Well, we know very well how to put that into a 2x2 matrix. We know that the determinant of this matrix is just the is p squared. And so if p squared equals 0, this determinant vanishes. If the determinant vanishes, it either means the matrix vanishes, which isn't interesting, or that it has rank 1. That's the interesting case. And if it's rank 1, that means that we can write it as the outer product of two vectors, lambda, lambda tilde, like that. Okay. Now, notice that we're beginning a long march here, as I mentioned, to talking about less and less redundant variables. Okay. So we're so happy with talking about massless momenta in the usual way that you have to stop to remember that it's a funny quadratically constrained thing that we do, right? We talked about a P0 and a P where the magnitude of P0 has got to equal the magnitude of P. There's this funny quadratic lying around, which is worse when there's masses around where you actually see the square root, right? So we just want to not use redundant variables. We just want to give a bunch of variables and just have them automatically be massless, okay? So that's what this is doing. If I just hand you a lambda and a lambda tilde, you build that matrix, automatically it's going to be null. You don't have to by hand impose any constraint that the magnitude of P0 is equal to the magnitude of P, okay? Now, a quick comment. If the momentum is real, then this matrix is Hermitian. If that matrix is Hermitian, that means that lambda tilde has got to be the complex conjugate of lambda. So real momenta, in real, in 3-1 signature, good old-fashioned real momenta, lambda tilde is the complex conjugate of lambda. Without apology, for the rest of these, two lectures, everything is going to be complex. Okay, we're going to complexify everything in sight. If we complexify everything, then lambda and lambda tilde are independent complex variables. And as independent complex variables, the complexified Lorentz group, so the normal Lorentz group is just SL2C, any 2x2 linear transformations on lambda and the appropriate conjugate on lambda tilde, the complexified Lorentz group is two copies of SL2C. So we have a separate SL2, and since it's going to be C almost all the time, I won't bother writing it down. There's going to be SL2 cross SL2 with the lambdas, where one SL2 acting on the lambdas, and the other SL2 acting on the lambda tildes. Okay. Now, sometimes it'll be useful to imagine that lambda, and lambda tilde are independent real variables. If lambda and lambda tilde are independent real variables, then this 2x2 matrix we're talking about is just a general real 2x2 matrix. We don't have any I's there, just P0 plus P3, P0, P1 minus P2, P1 plus P2, and so on. And so if you look at the determinant of that matrix, it's just P0 squared plus P3 squared minus P1 squared minus P2 squared. So it has 2 comma 2 signature, 2 pluses and 2 minuses. So lambda and lambda tilde being independent real variables corresponds to doing physics in 2 comma 2 signature. And in this case, the Lorentz group is really SL2. Here I'll write it down, R cross SL2, R. Part of the point is that we can roughly speaking compute amplitudes in any damn signature we want, and continue the answer to any other signature. In fact, we won't talk about reality conditions typically until the very, 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 very end of the calculation. If you like, The fact that amplitudes have an analytic continuation away from lambda tilde equals lambda star is another remarkable, interesting fact, which is not at all obvious ahead of time. Okay? So this is yet another one of a bazillion indications that there is something going on that's invisible in Feynman diagrams. But it's true. It's not guaranteed ahead of time. You have to sort of write them down. You write them down, and then you notice that they have this fast, you can decouple lambda and lambda tilde, and they have separate analytic properties, and you can treat them as separate variables. Okay, so now I advertise this as, let's just return the case of a 3-1 signature for a second. I advertise these variables as giving you unconstrained variables out of which you could build a light-like vector. But there seems to be a problem. The light-like vector naively has four components, but really has three because of this quadratic constraint. So we really have 3 degrees of freedom. But in my lambda, lambda tilde is the complex conjugate of lambda, so really I just have lambdas worth of degrees of freedom. It's a two-dimensional complex vector. That's 4 degrees of freedom again. So what's going on? What's going on is obvious. The lambda and the lambda tilde are actually not uniquely defined. If I give you a p, I can't uniquely hand you a lambda and a lambda tilde. You can rescale lambda and lambda tilde by any phase, and that keeps P invariant. Okay. So isn't that bad? Haven't we just reintroduced this redundancy we're trying to get rid of? This is not only not bad, this is a spectacular. Okay. Because that freedom is precisely the action of the little group. After all, what is a little group? The little group is associated with transformations that you do that keep the light-like vector fixed. Okay. So we could go through this in some pedantic detail. If you're going to do this in some pedantic detail, what you would do is this, really mimicking the little group Wigner's construction. You would say, pick some reference k. For that reference k, define the lambda and the lambda tilde. Then define the lambda and the lambda tilde for all other p by doing a Lorentz transformation on that reference guy. Now do a Lorentz transformation on the lambdas, and then you'll find that that Lorentz transformation on the lambdas so defined doesn't just go over itself, but goes into itself up to a phase. Okay, and that phase is precisely the action of the little group. Thank you, sir. That was getting annoying. Yeah. Okay. So that means that amplitudes are not actually functions of lambda and lambda tilde. Well, they are functions of lambda and lambda tilde. But the helicities that the particles have, no one has to tell you what they are. You can actually just read off what they are from the structure of the answer. Okay? When you do a phase transformation on lambda and the opposite one on lambda tilde, we're going to do it in general complex. So we'll do it in general as... So under lambda goes to T lambda, lambda A goes to TA lambda A, lambda tilde A goes to TA inverse lambda tilde A, M of T lambda, T inverse lambda tilde has to equal T to the negative 2HA M of lambda and lambda tilde. So the amplitude has to have a specific homogeneity under rescaling under lambda and lambda tilde. The 2 is there just because for a spin, obviously the 1 on lambda is for a spin a half. Okay, so and the minus sign is conventional. So let's go back here and see how this is borne out. Oh, I should have said one more thing, sorry. One more bit of notation. Because the Lorentz group is just trivially SL2 cross SL2, the only invariants that we can build are just contracting lambdas with an epsilon symbol or contracting lambda tildes with a. So all the invariants there are things like lambda 1, lambda 2 is epsilon alpha beta, lambda 1 alpha, lambda 2 beta, and lambda tilde 1, lambda tilde 2 equals epsilon alpha dot beta dot lambda tilde 1 alpha dot lambda tilde 2 beta dot. Those are all the invariants that we can have. And when there's no danger of confusion, we'll write things down like 1, 2, or 1, 2 to specify that guy and that guy. Okay? So just to do an example, what is something really simple like S, like P1 plus P2 squared? What is P1 plus P2 squared in this language? P1 plus P2 squared is 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. And that makes sense because it doesn't have any little group weight. It doesn't have any weight under rescaling lambda 1 or lambda 2, which is good because the P's don't have such a weight. Okay? This thing has weight everywhere. Which is good because it's describing the amplitude for a bunch of particles which have helicity. So let's just check that I'm not lying to you, at least as far as the helicities are concerned. For example, if I rescale 1 by T1, there's 4 ones upstairs, there's 2 ones downstairs. So this thing scales like T1 squared, which is T1 to the negative negative 2. Therefore, particle 1 has helicity minus 1. Right. Similarly, rescaling 2, there's nothing upstairs, there's 2 2's downstairs, so 2 has helicity plus 1. If you added 2 of these guys with the wrong homogeneities, then it's meaningless, right? So every piece of the amplitude, the whole thing has to have some fixed correct homogeneity under little group scaling. And again, as I said, this is why you should finally feel good. You've finally seen an amplitude. That's what an amplitude actually looks like. It's not redundantly expressed with some polarization vector or something. That's honest to goodness what it looks like. And the generalization of these, the question I mentioned in the beginning is the generalization of these variables to any field theory in any number of dimensions. Okay? And that is, at least in the literature, still an open problem, even though I think many of us sort of know the answer. And the answer is well known. It's been published in 6 dimensions due to a lovely paper of Donal O'Connell and Cliff Chung. And in 10 dimensions, Donal and Simon Caron-Huel I've worked with it. Nathan Berkovitz knows all these things, forwards and backwards. But I mean, written in a form actually usable and concrete. This would be a nice thing to write down somewhere and just have in the beginning of some future volume 1 of someone's field theory book. Okay. But anyway, we know the answer in 4 dimensions. Okay. Well, we also know it in 3 dimensions. In 3 dimensions, by the way, it's a lot simpler, but it's much less interesting. In 3 dimensions, just P equals lambda lambda. Okay. So there isn't a lambda and a lambda tilde. There's just a lambda and a lambda. It's just a symmetric matrix. So there's no holomorphy. So we don't get to continue independently lambda and lambda tilde. And that's part of the reason why why it's not so obvious what to do with scattering amplitude in 3 dimensions. However, you will not be surprised that since we know there's the ABJM theory in 3 dimensions, and we know the ABJM theory is intimately connected to the N equals 4 theory is intimately connected to everything else, that people have been seeing in the last year how to actually do computations that you didn't think were easy to do in 3 dimensions. They're actually not so bad to do. And we're seeing essentially exactly the same structure showing up in the ABJM theory that are seen in the N equals 4 superdiagonals. Anyway, that's a side comment. But 4 dimensions is certainly the sort of nicest place to start playing with this, which is also happily the dimensionality of our space-time.
Sorry.
Yes.
So given a pair of lambda and lambda,
yes.
How do you choose which one to call lambda?
Well, there's just two. I mean, the Lorentz group is SL2 cross SL2. So whoever transforms into the first SL2 are called lambdas. The other ones are called lambda tildes. That's all. Okay, so let's now use this formalism to get our first incredible payoff. Okay, so I told you one set of amplitudes that were computed by Park and Taylor. Let's get a set under our own power. And this already is a remarkable illustration of why it's so good to work with these nice, very invariant variables. What I want to do is write down all possible three-point functions, all three-point amplitudes. Three-point amplitudes are completely fixed up to a constant by Poincaré symmetry. There's absolutely no freedom in what they can be, and we'll just write them down. But before writing them down, and this is it's extremely similar to the fact that three-point correlation functions in conformal field theories are also nailed for primaries are nailed by conformal symmetry. It's an almost identical argument, okay? But it's simpler. But before talking about it, the first thing we need to do is say, what the heck does a three-point amplitude mean? Because this is not something we normally talk about in our field theory courses. And and it's always a sort of a bit of a pity, especially when you're first learning things, because it's clear that the three-point vertex is a sort of fundamental thing. And yet somehow the amplitudes only start off being interesting for four-point processes, for two-to-two processes. That's actually a fake. The three-point amplitude is well-defined. So why is a three-point amplitude normally not well-defined? It's normally not well-defined because there's no phase space for it, for massless particles, right? We can't have P1 split to P2 plus P3 unless P2 and P3 are exactly collinear with each other, so there's no phase space for the process at all, okay? But that's actually an artifact of real momenta. If you work with complex momenta, perfectly fine. You can have three-point vertex for generic momenta. This is true in any number of dimensions. By the way, this statement I'm about to make, the amplitudes are nailed in any number of dimensions. The three-point amplitudes are nailed in any number of dimensions. We'll write them down explicitly for four dimensions. But just so you see the importance of complex momenta here, you know, imagine you have, I don't know, this 1, 1, 0, 0 here. And I want this to go to, a half, what do I want to do? I know what I want to put over here. Okay. Yeah, here. Okay. So here's something which, damn it. All momenta are incoming, sorry. Okay. So here's something which conserves momentum. The momenta are not all parallel to each other, okay? And the really important point is that I managed to, is that I've added something here in these components, which normally I can't do, because it wouldn't keep it massless, but if I put the I there, everything is still fine, and these are all null vectors. P1, P2, and P3 are all null vectors. So you can have, for much more generic momenta, three-point processes, and you can associate a three-point amplitude with it. And obviously we could tack on as many more zeros as we want there, so this is true in any number of dimensions. But let's stick with four dimensions for a second. So let's see. So let's understand in more detail what momentum conservation tells us in the language of these spinor helicity variables. So this is just writing down P1 plus P2 plus P3 equals 0. Okay. Now, let's imagine contracting the alpha dot index, I don't know, with lambda tilde 2 for fun, okay? Then what we get from here is lambda 1 alpha, 1, 2. This one vanishes, and what we get from there is lambda 3 alpha, 3, 2, is equal to 0. Okay? So we notice something interesting. that that if these angle brackets are non-zero, if even one of them is non-zero, then the lambdas 1 and 3 have got to be proportional to each other. Okay? And obviously you can repeat this for any pair of them and come quickly to the conclusion that there is something special about kinematics for the three-point function. Okay? But the special thing is that either the lambdas are all proportional, or the lambda tildes are all proportional. Okay. One or the other. So that means that either all of the ij's vanish, or all of the I tilde j tildes vanish. Right? If these two guys are proportional to each other, if you can contract them with an epsilon symbol, it'll vanish. So there's two kinds of kinematic configurations for the three-point function. Either the lambdas are all proportional, or the lambda tildes are all proportional to each other. Now, you should have expected this, because let's just do a simple exercise, even without any of this spinner helicity crap. Let's just think about, what could, I don't know, the phi-cubed vertex be? Well, we know the answer is a constant. But imagine any old thing, right? Imagine any old theory, but just with scalars. What could this possibly be? It can only be a function of the Mandelson variables. Oops, we have p1 plus p2 squared is p3 squared. That's zero, right? p1 dot p2 is zero. p1 dot p, all the pi dot pj is zero. There are no Mandelson invariants at all. There's nothing for it to be a function of. So you immediately learn, if you have any scalar theory at all, the three-point function is a constant, period. Can't be anything else. So the only things that it can have, the only thing it carries, is the quintessence of what the helicities of the particles are. See, this is what we see here. Either one or the other is zero. If you take the product of any two of them, it vanishes. So that's because there's no pi dot pj's. They all vanish. So all we have are the ij's, the angle brackets, or the square brackets, and their only purpose in life is to tell us the helicities of the particles. Okay. So using that information, we can immediately write down the answer for any theory, for any spin particles. So I'll leave it for you as an exercise for general spin S1, S2, S3. Let's do it in the special case where all the spins are the same. But let's say that 1 is minus, 2 is minus, and 3 is plus. Okay. All right, well, the amplitude can either be a function of the angle brackets or the square brackets, one or the other. Let's say it's a function of the angle brackets. Then all it can be is something that looks a little funny at first, but it's 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the power of s times a constant. Okay. So let's check that that's the right answer. If I rescale 1, there's 3 ones upstairs and 1 downstairs, so there's a net 2 upstairs, so that's spin negative s. Similarly for 2, and similarly for 3 the other way. Okay. And of course, if these had indices A, B, C, then this would be some C, A, B, C. Now, actually, I could have written down thing. I could have written down everything with angle brackets and raised it to the power of negative s. Those are the two things I could have done, right? I would have exactly the same properties. The only thing I can't have is have both of them together, because either one set vanish or the other set vanish. Okay? So I write this one down, because this one has the property that it vanishes in the limit of real momenta. When the momenta are all real, this thing vanishes, right? When all these, when you see in this configuration, the lambda tildes are all proportional to each other. The lambda tildes are all their angle brackets are zero. That's fine. They don't show up. This is for generic complex momenta, because these are not equal to the complex conjugate of those. But in the limit that I make the momenta real, that means all these angle brackets are going to vanish. But you see, there's three upstairs and two downstairs, and so the limit of real momenta makes this thing, even when you take the limit properly, Martin Schmaltz, vanishes. Okay. If you did it the other way with the lambda tildes, it would diverge. So by demanding that you have the correct physical limit and limit of real momenta, that this process that shouldn't happen doesn't happen, you nail the answer. Okay, what about the other one? What about if it's 1 plus 2 plus 3 minus? Well, it's exactly the same thing. 1, 2 cubed over 1, 3, 2, 3 to the S again. Okay, just with the angle brackets. What about with all plus? Well, this is just 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 1 to the power of S.
About the
yeah.
Logic,
yes.
So there were two choices in the square of angle brackets.
Yes.
And one of them is wrong.
One of them is wrong, yeah. Yeah. One of them diverges, yeah. Exactly. One of them is simply wrong, right. Yes. Yeah. One of them is wrong, and the right one is unique up to a constant. So you notice something very interesting. The all plus amplitude, for example, just has different units than the two pluses and a minus and two minuses and a plus. Okay. So if we imagine going back to a Lagrangian for a second, they're not coming from the same terms in the action. In fact, these things are coming from the two derivative terms. These things come from F cubed terms in Yang-Mills, R cubed terms in gravity, and so on. Okay, so they're from higher order terms, and you can see that because they're sort of pure polynomial. Okay. And you can also just see it by the dimensionality of the coupling constant out in front. So these are associated with higher dimension operators. Let me just pause here to say a number of very simple but wonderful things. One of them is that we've written down the three-point function for any theory. Okay. Now, if you look at the three-point function in Yang-Mills, that's fairly nice. We know what it is. Just the amplitude. If you contract with polarization factors, you'll find this eventually. If you look at the three-point vertex in gravity, this is a nightmarish object already with a bazillion terms. Okay. I forget whether the bazillion is 30 or 80. I think in de Donder gauge it's 80 terms or something like that. But it's ridiculous. Okay. And yet, all that information is just all that information is gone on shell. It's just this beautiful thing. And furthermore, the three-point function for Yang-Mills for gravity is the square of the three-point function for Yang-Mills. This is the most basic element of this famous squaring relationship that many people have made a living off of, and Zvi and friends have taken to new heights in the last remarkable new heights in the last number of years. But this is in the most purest form. It couldn't be simpler, and yet it's completely unobvious from the Lagrangian. Right? The 80 terms on one side and the one term in Yang-Mills on the other side. It's totally unobvious. Let me say another thing about this. There's a whole literature of people, somewhat misguided people, who've spent 15 years of their lives coming up with higher spin theory in ADS. That's not misguided remotely, but people doing this in flat space. Okay? There are people who try to write down interacting high spin Lagrangians using all sorts of complicated BRST formalism and all sorts of stuff I don't understand. And they finally did it. After lots of blood, sweat, and tears, they finally did it. They managed to write down a three-point function. Well, big whoop, so did we. Okay. That's the answer. That's invariantly the answer. You don't need to do any work to write down the answer. Now, after they conquered this tremendous beast, and now they off they go to try to generalize this to four-point functions, and we know ahead of time that they're going to fail. You see, it's trivial to write down three-point functions for any spin. Spin 17, it's not a problem. Okay? It's pure group theory, pure kinematics. Yes. Yes. Nope. No, no. That's the entire minus minus plus. Can't be anything else. We can, I won't go through it in detail, but we can go through the entire sort of logic that in some reversed order leads to Weinberg's theorem. The only consistent theories of massless spin 1 particles are Yang-Mills for spin 1, GR for spin 2, and so on. That logic can be, that logic, as wonderful as it is the way Weinberg did it, can be done even more airtightly. From this on-shell viewpoint. The point is, these are the only possible three-point functions. You then write down the only possible four-point function you can. Okay? You write down the four-point function. You can strip off a factor that's pure trivial kinematics like this. The rest is the function of S, T, and U. You write down the most general function of S, T, and U that you can. Then there is a physical requirement. The physical requirement is that on when this function develops poles, it needs to factorize into the product of the lower three-point amplitudes. That's putting in locality. Okay? And if you just do that exercise, you find that it's impossible with these three-point functions that you can't write down any function of S, T, and U which factorizes correctly unless you have massless spin 1 particle, unless you have gravity for massless spin 2, Yang-Mills for massless spin 1, where the CABC satisfy the Jacobi identity. And you can't do anything else. So that's why these people will never succeed in coming up with some new funky interacting spin 17 Lagrangian. Doesn't matter what you do with the Lagrangian. Okay? That's all incredibly off-shell, non-invariant stuff. This is the real deal. This is the bottom line. And so you can see very clearly ahead of time what you can get and what you can't get. Okay? I'll give you another trivial example. It's very well known, in fact, we'll prove at some point, that in supersymmetric theories, all plus amplitudes vanish. Period. Just as a consequence of supersymmetry. That tells you right away, without any work, that in a supersymmetric theory, we can't have that vertex. Therefore, there's no supersymmetric R-cubed operators. Period. You don't have to, no superspace, no worry about missing terms, this, that, and the other, nothing. It's just a direct consequence of the amplitude. I mean, the basic point is the amplitude contains invariant information, and so that's the invariant information. It has lots of content. Okay. Now, what's the time frame here?
I figured that maybe we should go to T at some point.
Okay. Great, perfect. That's a good place to stop. Terrific. Okay, so as I said, today isn't all about excitement. Well, some, but it's really about getting all the kinematics straight. So let's keep going with, I want to add one final bit to the discussion of kinematics and then talk about something a little more interesting, which is the symmetries. And the best spaces in which to study them. And then, Ruth will give her, if it's anything like the previous talks by her, I heard that she'll give her a wonderful discussion of BCFW and whatever else she wants to talk about tomorrow. And that'll also lay some work for starting to tell you about some of the new, as I mentioned, there are these extraordinary mathematical structures that are being added, and you will start seeing some of them in the second lecture. But today we're just going to finish laying groundwork to start seeing, as I mentioned, seeing the structure peek out unencumbered by needless distractions. Okay, so we've seen that now something that'll become clear after Ruth's lecture, but which I'll just say now, is and this is another very zero, very very zeroth order thing that makes you suspect there's something up. There's so many things like this we could talk about. we could talk about them in the abstract all day. But let's just talk about this one quickly. You might think, as I did, just starting to think about this subject, I thought, well, all these people are doing all these fancy things with gauge theories and stuff like that. I'm a simple person. I'm just going to study phi to the fourth theory. They're not studying phi to the fourth theory. Ha ha, I have a head start. No one has studied phi to the fourth theory. So I spent, I won't tell you how many months studying phi to the fourth theory, learning spinner helicity variables and doing all this stuff, and you discover something terrible. Phi to the fourth theory sucks, okay? Really, the amplitudes suck. They're as complicated as you expect from Feynman diagrams. No simpler. There's no structure, no beautiful structure in phi to the fourth scattering amplitudes. Maybe this shouldn't have surprised you, because phi to the fourth theory does suck in every other way. Hierarchy problem, blah, blah, blah. But still, it came as a little bit of a surprise to me, because you'd think, oh, the simple place to get started, forget about all this spin and all these complicated things, we'll deal with phi to the fourth theory. Phi to the fourth theory is complicated. In fact, I should have said this, just another small point of a philosophy. A lot of this business might sound superficially like the S-matrix program of the 1960s. Okay? There are some points of commonality. The most obvious one, that we're both interested in the S-matrix and computing scattering amplitudes. But actually, the philosophy in many ways is exactly the opposite as what it was back then. And there's some very important technical differences as well. So let me say first the sort of point of philosophy. The point of philosophy is that the S-matrix people thought that all they needed to do was impose the analytic, look at the analytic properties of the S-matrix and impose unitarity and causality, unitarity and locality, and they would nail the answer. Okay? That was the dream. Now, of course, we know that that's just false, because there's an infinite number of Lagrangians that we can write down. They're all consistent field theories of locality and unitarities, and they don't. So we can't uniquely determine the S-matrix like that. But really, more to the point, they actually had no idea what unitarity and causality looked like precisely as a statement about analytic structure of the S-matrix in a way that was controllable and usable to nail the answer. So they were taking those principles as sacrosanct and trying to make the analytic properties slaves to them, make the structure of the amplitude slaves to them, right? Our attitude, certainly my attitude, and I think the attitude of a lot of people, at least in the direction of imagining some reformulation of field theory, is that that's precisely the opposite of what we're trying to do. It's not that there is such a thing as the principle of causality and this is what it looks like in the analytic structure and the principle of locality. There are some other principles that just allow you to write down the answer. And that's fine that there's tons of theories. That's good. So there's going to be some rubric of consistent ways of building scattering amplitudes. But some new structure, not our imposition of causality and unitarity, but some new structure controlling the answer will then show us that things like locality and unitarity pop out. So we're not, it's exactly the opposite in spirit. And in fact, they knew that there was something wrong with what they were doing. If you look at the old analytic S-matrix books, for example, they have this whole first chapter, which sounds motivationally very similar to some of the things that I was saying. And then the whole rest of the book is about looking at Feynman diagrams, studying the analytic structure of Feynman diagrams, because they have no idea what locality and what the analytic properties of amplitudes should be on totally general grounds. They just guess by staring at what Feynman diagrams do, and then they come back and try to bootstrap their way to the answer like that. So that's one essential philosophical difference. But also technically, and this is really ironic, technically, they were attacking the S-matrix of the hardest possible problem without knowing it. They were looking at the scattering amplitude of massive spin number one, scalars, spin number two. That's the hardest, worst possible problem to try to expose some simplicity in amplitudes from the modern point of view, which occurs for massless particles of high spin. Their attitude towards spin was exactly, you know, is, oh, well, it's some complicated, well, we'll deal with it later. But all the wonderful things happen for particles of high spin, which again dovetails very nicely with the fact that it's the particles of high spin which the standard formalism starts suffering under the weight of making locality and unitarity manifest. Part of the fourth theory is perfectly fine, right? So it stands to reason that if there's some new picture, the things that are easy in the usual picture will be hard in that picture and vice versa. So part of the fourth theory does suck, but theories of spin one particles are nice. And even though this intuition hasn't been substantiated enough, there's lots of reasons to suspect that the gravity amplitudes are even nicer than gauge amplitudes. But it's really completely the opposite of what you'd expect from the inspection of the Lagrangian. Okay. Yeah?
There are some aspects of locality and causality that seem to have right, for instance, like clustering.
Sure, right. Yes, yes, right, right, right.
Mm-mm.
No. I think no. Certainly, no one is complaining. I mean, we all know what the amplitude should do in certain limits, right? The question is whether the divergence in the philosophy is whether you take what you know it looks like in that limit and this limit and this limit, and then you try to make a guess for something that matches in all the limits, or whether you sort of get the objects from somewhere else, assemble them together, and then see that it has this these properties. Of course, in practice, you make progress whatever the heck way you can at any point in time, and lots and lots of progress has been going on. You look at what things do, you know what kind of factorization properties you expect from Feynman diagrams at tree level, at loop level, so you know what to expect. A lot of the power of the recursive techniques is using that information and, you know, writing down recursion relations. Really, that's what the analytic S-matrix program would have been had it not been truncated. It would have, I think, naturally, eventually gone in that direction. But simply for the purpose of doing the computation, that's totally fine. Of course, there's nothing wrong with using known properties of the field theory answer. What's remarkable, though, is that when you stare at the answer in that form, it has properties that you don't see from the Lagrangian. That's what's so interesting, is that there is this intermediate way derived from field theory. So you know for a fact that it's true, but it's some. But it's clearly hinting at also coming from some second place. It has symmetries that are completely unobvious from the Lagrangian. It has other properties that are totally unobvious from the Lagrangian. It's being put together in ways which, on the one hand, you understand from the Lagrangian, but which clearly is begging to be understood in some totally different geometric way from somewhere else. There's a sort of fascinating halfway house between, you know, standard field theory on the one hand and something else on the other. And that's what I think, you know, they also didn't have data. They didn't have theoretical data. They had lots of experimental data, of course, but they didn't have all this perfect theoretical data. I think Lance had this wonderful review of the scattering amplitudes recently. I think a number of people have referred to in this program, called the sort of, what was the title exactly? The most perfect microscopic structures in the universe. And I think it's really true. They don't lie. And every term in that perturbative expansion has lots of information in it. So in practice, things go back and forth, of course, all the time. But that's I think a big, if you like, sociological difference, is that the S-matrix program was very ideological. And this approach is very pragmatic. You do anything you can to compute the next amplitude, and then and hopefully you learn something from it. So that song and dance was just meant to tell you that we should like these helicity indices. We should think that these theories are nicer than theories with just scalars. All right. But then instantly there's something annoying about this, especially if you're a physicist. There are all these horrible discrete labels. So there's for n particles, there's 2 to the n different components that we should be talking about. Okay. That's just annoying. it's annoying to have a smooth function, but to have 2 to the n different smooth functions. So so what we're going to do is change the theory so that we are talking about, again, the sort of goal here is to talk about amplitudes in as simple a way as possible. So having 2 to the n discrete labels is complicated, so we're going to make life simpler. Okay? To make life simpler, what we need to do is find a symmetry that relates the plus and minus labels to each other, so we can put them in a multiplet. Okay? And that's what motivates supersymmetry. So there's lots of ways of motivating supersymmetry, of course, that we're used to. But scattering amplitudes beg to be made supersymmetric. Even if you stare at non-supersymmetric amplitudes, they're telling you, they're pleading with you to be thought of in a supersymmetric way. Okay? As you'll see in a moment, that in that Park-Taylor formula, for example, we had these, maybe I should have written down, and I should have stressed, this is the tree amplitude. The tree amplitude with a bunch of pluses and 2 minuses in locations I and j is ij to the fourth over 1, 2, 2, 3, and 1. I should have said also that the all plus and all plus, all except 1 amplitude vanish at tree level. We'll prove that in a moment. But this thing is, so this is the first non-trivial scattering amplitude. These are called MHV, for maximal helicity violating, for historical reasons that people in the audience could tell you, which I don't know. I guess I could guess. And if you have amplitudes with 3 minuses, these would be called next to MHV. 4 minuses would be called next to MHV, and so on. But the simplest amplitudes of all are these MHV amplitudes. So that's what it is at tree level. And so you can see, well, there's something here that's, this is almost perfectly symmetrical, right? I mean, these particles have Bose's statistics. So, you should think, I should have said, I didn't yet define stripping off the color factor. I'll come to that in a second. Anyway, this thing wants to treat these guys totally democratically and cyclically, except for the fact of these 2 crappy minus guys sitting in the middle, right? And so you can see that. If you ignore the things about the 2 crappy minus guys, the denominator is completely cyclic and beautiful, okay? But the information about the 2 sort of defects is sitting there on the ij to the fourth. And as we'll see in a second, everything about this is screaming to be made supersymmetric. That 4 is telling you about n equals 4 super Yang mills. The analogous formula in gravity has an 8 upstairs. It's got a more complicated denominator, but there is a numerator with something to the 8. And if you just computed it with, in good old-fashioned pure gravity, you see these 8 powers in the numerator everywhere. And that 8 is telling you that it wants to be thought of as in terms of n equals 8 supergravity. Okay? And the reason is that amplitudes want to be thought of in a supersymmetric way. And the reason is, and not only in a supersymmetric way, but in a maximally supersymmetric way. And that's because there's something unique about maximal supersymmetry. Maximal supersymmetry indeed unifies the positive and negative, all the helicities, into one multiplet. Okay? So if you take n equals, you know, so here we start off n equals 0. We have a plus and a minus helicity gluon. Wonderful. Let's make it n equals 1 supersymmetric. Okay? Well, okay, so we have a positive a half gay geno here and a negative half spin negative. God, what am I doing? Plus 1. Why am I putting the pluses at the bottom? Plus, minus a half, minus 1. Okay? Okay, that's very good. So if you're going to describe the n equals 1 amplitudes, you've actually made your life a little worse. Now you have to talk, you still have to carry around two different kinds of multiplets, sort of positive helicity guys, two of them, and the negative helicity guys with two of them. It's only with n equals 4 that with the four supercharges, we can ladder our way up from the bottom to the top to go from minus 1, so one of these guys, four of these guys, six scalars, and one here. Okay. So I take the four supercharges. There's four Qs and four Q tildes. They anti-commute to one. Okay. So I can think of the Qs as raising operators, let's say, starting at the bottom. And I can act with them four times to go from the bottom to the top. So in this way, I fill out this whole multiplet. And so I unify all the helicities into one supermultiplet. Okay? This should make talking about the states vastly easier. In fact, we shouldn't talk about them in terms of helicity states anymore. That's very unnatural. Okay? The helicity states are all being combined in a supermultiplet. So we should use the power of that supersymmetry to help us. If you like, we have the Qs and we have Q tildes. And they anti-commute. Okay, so this is delta ij, lambda tilde alpha dot. Okay, the way they act on shell states. And the point is that look, we have these symmetries. So just like when we have momenta, when we have the Poincaré group, we diagonalize everything we can. We diagonalize the momenta. So we should diagonalize everything we can when we have supersymmetry. We should diagonalize one of the Qs. We can't diagonalize both of them because they don't commute, but we can diagonalize one of the Qs. Okay? So instead of talking about states that are specific helicity states, let's talk about states that are eigenstates of Q, or Q tilde. I think for conventional reasons, I will talk about eigenstates of I hope I don't screw up my notation in the middle, but okay. Yeah, let me talk about, let's say, eigenstates of Q. So these are going to have to be some Grassmann coherent states. And so what can this be? Well, something's got to eat up the alpha index. Something's got to eat up the I index. So this eta is going to have an I index. So this is going to be just lambda alpha, eta I, acting on eta I. Concretely, the etas are just a combination of all of those those states. How would I write eta explicitly? I would write eta as e. I'd like to write it as e to the q tilde eta acting on, let's say, the plus helicity state. Now let's try to make sense of this. So this guy has Q tilde has an upstairs index, eta has a downstairs index, Q tilde has an alpha dot index. So what am I going to do with that alpha dot index? Well, it's obvious really what I mean, right? I really want whatever this Q tilde is to be the ladder operator, literally the ladder operator, which acts on plus to take it to plus a half and brings me down. Okay, so just formally, let me something I'll call a W alpha dot. W alpha dot's only purpose in life is to be something that's orthogonal to lambda tilde alpha dot. Sorry, not orthogonal. Just normalized to be one. Okay. So pick any W that's not unique. You can translate it by we can translate it by anything proportional to lambda tilde alpha dot. But they all give us exactly the same answer. Okay. And so concretely, what this is a state which is plus eta I times the state with plus a half I plus a half eta I eta j times the spin zero state ij plus 1 over 3 factorial eta I eta j eta k times the minus a half state with which I can think of, so there's four of these, but I can think of it as a anti-symmetric combination of three, four vectors at the top, and then plus 1 over 4 factorial, eta I, eta j, eta k, eta l, times minus 1, I, j, k, l. So this thing is really proportional to the epsilon symbol, and so it's just the negative helicity law. So these are the states on which supersymmetry acts as nicely as possible. It's a combination of the specific helicity states. And you can see that the two supersymmetries, Q and Q tilde, act on these states in a very simple way. For example, the Q tilde supersymmetry, if I do e to the Q tilde, zeta tilde, acting on eta, I just translate eta. Okay? It's just a translation in eta. Okay? So e to the zeta tilde q tilde acting on eta is eta plus something plus zeta tilde lambda tilde. Okay? I did that wrong. Zeta tilde W. Yeah, it's just translating eta. Yeah, we can get the indices straight in a second. Whereas the other one, the e to the zeta q, acts on the state and gives you a phase, right? Because eta is an eigenstate of q. So e to the zeta q acts on eta and just gives you a multiplicative factor. Okay? So the two supersymmetries act nicely on these states. Okay? So that's the point. We've just diagonalized q. We could also diagonalize q tilde if we like. And going from q to q tilde, how do I go from an eigenstate of q to an eigenstate of, so I have eigenstates of q and eigenstates of q tilde, and I go back and forth just using Fourier transformation, just Grassmann Fourier transformation. Okay. So I have states eta, states eta tilde I, eta tilde I, and this state eta tilde I is literally d4, or let me put dn, for n is the number of n equals 4 or 8, depending on whether we're doing Yang moles of gravity. It's just dn eta, e to the eta, eta tilde, eta. Okay. So, and if I like, for any external particle, I can choose to label it either by the eta state or the eta tilde state. Doesn't make any difference. Although by convention, it's nicest to label everyone by the same. The same. Okay. For some purposes, we'll find it convenient not to do that. But here, this is good enough. So now we have something new. We have m of lambda tilde for each particle. And let me choose to label everyone, just so I remember my own notation, by eta tilde. Okay? Gone are the discrete variables. Now we have a smooth function of bosonic variables and Grassmann variables. Four bosonic variables and four Grassmann variables. All right. Okay? Or four and eight if we're doing supergravity. If I want any particular helicity component, what do? I just for example, if I want a state with positive helicity, I just integrate d4 eta tilde for that particle. Okay. Yes. Oh, sorry. The eta's a Grassmann. You see. The omega is a complex number. This is just a number that normalizes lambda. Okay. This is just a bosonic number. The etas are Grassmann, and they just carry an I index, and I runs from 1 to n. Right, and so I can project out whatever component that I want just by integrating with the appropriate, multiplying by the appropriate power of eta tilde to pull out whichever component I like. Well, we'll do an explicit example in a second. All right, now I just want to make another brief comment. Anyone who has played with n equals 4 supersymmetric theories, or never mind n equals 8 supergravity, knows the Lagrangians are complicated. And not only are they complicated, but no one has written the Lagrangians down in a way that makes the action of the supersymmetry completely manifest. This has always bugged anyone, certainly bugged me, anyone who learns about supersymmetry in the beginning. It's a really weird feature of supersymmetry that, unlike other global symmetries that you know and love, whether or not a Lagrangian has a symmetry depends on how smart the theorist is. It's not an invariant property. I mean, you know, it's not like a U1 symmetry where you know ahead of time what the action of a U1 is on some field. When the theory is supersymmetric, especially very supersymmetric, you can write down one and the same theory, and if you're smart enough to integrate in the right auxiliary field, you can say, aha, it's supersymmetric. And if you're not, well, tough luck. But that's very strange. The action of the symmetry is, first of all, complicated, and secondly, depends on, it's not God-given ahead of time. You have to go hunting around and looking for it. Isn't it a strange and awful thing that the most supersymmetric and beautiful theories like this have the worst hellish difficulty in giving them a Lagrangian expression? I think this is another deep clue that there's something wrong with Lagrangians. They make it very hard to see the action of these incredibly basic, simple things. In fact, people who've looked at this know that it's possible in gauge theories to get up to n equals 3. To make n equals 3 supersymmetry manifest. This is the most super-duper harmonic superspace of all. Makes n equals 3 supersymmetry manifest. You like, you're very French, and you know everything about harmonic superspace, and you make n equals 3 manifest. Okay. And that's fine. You see, there's a deep reason n equals 4 can't be made. There will never be. A local formulation of n equals 4, which is manifestly supersymmetric, and that's because of this deep fact that the representation is CPT self-conjugate. Okay? Even n equals 3 gives you two different representations: one for the top that starts off with the gluon at the top, and one of the gluon that starts off at the bottom. It's this essential fact which we see all over the place, even in the structure of the amplitudes, that when you write things in a manifestly supersymmetric way, it does not play nicely with locality. Okay? So pieces of it up to n equals 3 can be separately manifestly local, but the whole thing, making the whole supersymmetry manifest, is just fights with locality. And we see this very concretely in many other settings. Now in the context of n equals 4, we have a complete classification of all possible supersymmetric invariants. Heck, we have a classification of all possible Yangian invariants of this gigantic integrable structure that you'll hear about if you haven't heard about it already. Deep fact about this thing is that the things that are supersymmetric and Yangian invariant are not local. Full stop. Okay? bits and pieces, if you want to see n equals 3, if you want to see less, no problem. But if you want to see all the supersymmetry, it cannot be a local. That's why no one will ever find an n equals 4 local Lagrangian. But it should also, now never mind n equals 8. I mean, if someone had told me 10 years ago that I would one day work on n equals 8 supergravity, I would laugh in their face because, you know, I can't even look at n equals 0 gravity. I mean, I'm a very scared person. So never mind n equals 8, which is, you know, infinitely hard, and I haven't even looked at the Lagrangian. But you see, you don't need to. The action of supersymmetry is hellish in Lagrangians, and it's this beautiful, simple thing on shell. Totally invariant. It's not up to the theorist. It's a property of the theory. This is what supersymmetry does on the states. It's not up to you. It's not up to anybody. Okay? Completely invariant. There is, incidentally, a totally similar story. I mean, I won't go into it. But, I mean, a tiny version of exactly the same little drama occurred with the Bagger-Lambert theories, where exactly the same theory was written down by Bagger and Lambert in 1 year. Precisely the same theory is written down in the next year. The theory didn't change. What changed in the middle was the auxiliary fields that were added when the theory all of a sudden became n equals 8 supersymmetric. Okay? So, but if you like, and it's been done by now, you can, had you never heard of it, had they never existed, you could, setting up exactly the same kind of machinery, write down 3-point functions, 4-point higher, you could just discover the whole n equal, the whole structure that they found. Purely on shell, looking at the amplitudes, that's the invariant content. And it's possible to do it with no imagination. You know, it's just follows completely from symmetries. Okay. All right. Okay, now, I should have mentioned something early on, even in talking about specific helicities, that of course the amplitudes also have color indices. And one of the very early and very powerful things to do so that you don't drag FABCs around all over the place is to write all the, exploit the fact, very useful in SUN especially, exploit the fact that FABC is trace commutator of TA, TB, and TC, to imagine everywhere you had an FABC, write it out as that object. And then you can very easily see that that you get an expansion for the amplitude in terms of traces. Instead of having FABCs, you just have traces. And if you're only keeping planar diagrams, you have single traces. So you have a sum over all, in principle, all the permutations of A1 up to AN. I should have called this permutation sigma. Of M of P sigma 1, just okay. So for every different plus multi-trace and so on. So having pulled out these trace factors, the object that's left, which is really now doesn't have any color factors anymore, it's just a function of 1, 2 up to n, and it's just h1 up to hn. That's what we'd have non-supersymmetrically. Supersymmetrically, there's no h's anymore. We just have lambda a, lambda tilde a to tilde a. But now supersymmetrically, now that we've labeled all the states by the same kinds of external state, we don't have helicities anymore, all the external states are labeled by these same Grassmann coherent states, the underlying Bose symmetry of the theory is reflected very simply in the fact that this amplitude is simply cyclically invariant. Okay? So m of 1, 2 up to n is literally equal to m of n 1, 2, up to n minus 1, and so on. Okay, it's cyclic invariant. That's a big bonus that we get by dealing with the supersymmetric object. It's manifestly cyclically invariant. Okay? You get cyclically non-invariant things by projecting out particular components, but when expressed supersymmetrically, it's manifestly cyclically invariant. if we do this in n equals 8 supergravity, it's a function of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde again. Now the eta tildes have 8 indices, not 4. And now that object is fully permutation invariant. Okay. So we're seeing the sort of we're seeing the most basic symmetry properties totally unobscured now. Okay. So let me write down a particular example. So amplitudes are going to be things that depend on lambdas, lambda tildes, and eta tildes. And let me actually tell you the most basic eta tilde dependence that's got to be there in every amplitude. Okay, let me do it by actually first writing down a piece of the amplitude that we normally, it's so obvious that we normally just suppress it, which is the overall momentum conservation condition. So this is really the sum of lambda A, lambda tilde A, the sum over A. Okay. Now the theory is supersymmetric. So we should have a supersymmetric counterpart to that guy. Okay. And the supersymmetric counterpart to that guy is this delta function. How can you see that? You can see that by taking the amplitude and acting on it with the Q charge that multiplies the amplitude by a phase. So remember I told you that if you act on it, that these eta tildes are eigenstates of Q tilde, I guess. I'm going to get it mixed up. They're eigenstates of one of them. So if you act with e to the other q, if you act with e to that q on them, you get something which is e to lambda. So let's say it's q, eta tilde. Sorry, it's not the same notation as there, but is equal to lambda, eta tilde. Okay. Then if you do e to the q eta tilde, you get e, so if you do e to the zeta alpha I, q alpha I eta tilde, well, we're going to get e to the zeta alpha I sum over all a, lambda a, eta tilde a, I, zeta, oh, sorry, there it is, on eta tilde. Sorry, on any one of them, we're going to get this. On any one of them, we get it without the sum. So e to the zeta q on the amplitude is equal to e to the sum of that thing, e to the zeta times the sum of lambda eta tilde on the amplitude. It's really exactly the same argument as why there's the delta function for momentum conservation, right? When we do a translation, we get e to the I PA for each particle. When we act it on the whole amplitude, we get e to the I, the sum of all the momenta times the amount that we translated by. And the only way those two things can be equal if there's a delta function for momentum conservation. Okay? So it's exactly the same argument. Instead of a delta function for momentum conservation, we have a delta function that sets this Grassmann combination to zero. No, this is delta 2n. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So for it's because there's two components of lambda, and there's four components of eta tilde. Okay. So every scattering amplitude in the world, supersymmetric scattering amplitude, must have, just as a consequence of half the supersymmetry, it must have that delta function. Yeah, so let me stick with this one. Let me stick with this one. Okay. So I just defined what the eta tildes are. Okay. Yes.
I'm actually
Here, I've written it explicitly. Eta tilde is an eigenstate of Q. Eta tilde is an eigenstate of Q, so that Q alpha I eta tilde is lambda eta tilde eta tilde. Okay? Yes, look at the top blackboard. Sorry? I'm going to take it. Ignore the top blackboard. And I'll just write it all. Let me write it properly. Sorry, the problem in this business is that there's four different spaces, and I've spent most of my time in momentum twister space recently. So my eta and eta tildes are all mixed up. But anyway, this is literally what I mean. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And we could write it the other way. So, and in fact, it's a very nice exercise to do this. If you take this and you Fourier, so it's this times some function of the eta tildes, okay? Lambda, lambda tilde, eta tilde. And it's a very nice exercise to convince yourself that even if you just take this, that if you Fourier transform any such thing with respect to eta tilde, that you're necessarily going to get the other delta function as a function of lambda, instead of lambda eta tilde, you'll get lambda tilde eta in the conjugate variables. Okay? But this is very important. This is a chiral superspace. Okay? And that's because we can only diagonalize Q or Q tilde. And that's just life. Okay? So we're only going to see totally explicitly half of the supersymmetry at a time. But that's not, it's not like there's any more. This is life. This is what amplitudes are functions of. And actually, just to complete it and be completely wholly responsible, in this notation, eta tilde begins with plus and is eta tilde plus a half. Oh, where am I putting the indices? I plus dot 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 plus eta tilde to the fourth minus. Yes. Okay, so now everything is correct. Sorry about that. Okay, so let's return to not writing this down all the time, but we can write it down. So here's our first example of a fully supersymmetric amplitude. M of lambda, here is the Park-Taylor amplitude. The supersymmetric form of the Park-Taylor amplitude. Well, there's a delta 4 of momentum conservation, which we'll just write for fun. There's the delta 8, sum over A, lambda A, eta tilde A. And now it's just over the Park-Taylor denominator. So as promised, this is a beautifully cyclic object. Beautifully cyclically invariant under shifting everyone over by one. In fact, these delta functions are permutation invariant. This is the only thing that breaks the cyclic invariance. And now I have to tell you what exactly I mean by the Park-Taylor formula, because the Park-Taylor, we said it was for MHV. MHV was a number of negative helicity gluons. Well, we're not talking about the helicities of the gluons anymore. We're talking about these eta tildes. So what am I talking about? Well, this superamplitude naturally breaks up into sectors because it's a power series in eta tilde, right? It's a polynomial in the eta tildes. And because there's four eta tildes and there's an SU4 R symmetry, it breaks up into pieces with no eta tildes, with four eta tildes, with eight eta tildes, 12 eta tildes. In general, it breaks up into pieces with 4k eta tildes each. Okay? So we can write M of n of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde as a sum over k equals 0 to n of m n k of lambda, lambda tilde, eta tilde. where each piece here has 4k eta tildes in it. If you like, it has a homogeneity under rescaling all the eta tildes of 4k. Okay? So they're just different pieces with different numbers of eta tildes in it. You can very easily see, and we'll just verify it, we'll just see in a second, that this k, this is a superamplitude, but mnk is the one that contains amongst its component amplitudes the guys with k negative helicity gluons. Okay? So this superamplitude contains the gluonic amplitudes with k negative helicity gluons. All right. Let's actually just see that very quickly. Let's verify. Let's get from the formula that I wrote down. So what I really wrote down was Mn and 2, k equals 2 for Park Taylor, is and I'm delta 8 of the sum over A, lambda A, eta tilde A, over 1, 2, 2, 3, and 1. And let's get out of this the component. Let's say I want the component amplitude, which is the component, which is plus, plus, a bunch of plus, and then minus, and then minus, and the rest of the plus. And this is in location I, and that's in location J. Okay, well, how do I put all those pluses to zero? I put all those pluses to zero by sending the eta tildes for everything, for all the pluses to zero. Okay, remember, eta tilde, the state eta tilde was plus, plus eta tilde, plus a half, plus dot, dot, plus eta tilde to the fourth minus. So if I want to extract the piece with plus, it's really simple. I just put those eta tildes to zero. Okay? So I put all the eta tildes to zero except for I and J. Okay? Now, how do I pick out the minus components for I and J? Well, I just integrate over d4 eta tilde I and d4 eta tilde J. Right? And that picks out that component. Okay? So this is equal to the integral d4 eta tilde I, d4 eta tilde j of, well, so I put all the rest of them to zero up there, so it's delta 4, there's only two terms, lambda I, eta tilde I, plus lambda j, eta tilde j, over 1, 2, and 1. And what is this Grassmann integral? It's just I, j to the fourth. Yes, that's k, right? Yeah.
But that's sort of not manifested in the equation.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Because look at this. This is a polynomial in eta tilde. There's 8 eta tildes in it. It's delta 8 eta tilde. So there's 8 eta tildes in it. So that's k equals 2. You can read off precisely what k it has just by its homogeneity under rescaling all the eta tildes. You rescale all the eta tildes, and it picks up. If for k equals 3, you'd have something like this, and then it would have some terms in it with 4 eta tildes here. It would have more eta tildes. You have terms with more and more eta tildes in them.
And the fact that it vanishes for...
Very good. So the fact that it vanishes now for k equals 0 and k equals 1 should be almost obvious to you, because every single thing has got to have that delta function in it by supersymmetry, so that's the easiest way of seeing that it has to have k equals 2. But actually, if you want to see it a little more formally, the proof proceeds, I'll leave this as an exercise, it's an incredibly simple proof, but the proof proceeds as follows. Let's say, let me do the simplest one. Let me prove that the all plus amplitude vanishes. Well, let me It's such a pretty and straightforward proof. I think I won't spoil it. I won't spoil it for you. You should. That's a wonderful little exercise to prove. It's a completely trivial proof from the superspace that the amplitude vanishes for k equals 0 and k equals 1. Basically, you use the supersymmetry to move the eta tildes. You can use the supercharges to translate the eta tildes anywhere you want, and you can actually use it to translate two of the eta tildes to 0 if you like. Up to two of the one or two of the eta tildes to 0, and using that fact, you can trivially prove that the k equals 1 and the k equals 2 amplitudes vanish. The k equals 0 and the k equals 1 amplitudes vanish. And there is a tiny and interesting subtlety there. So having done the Park-Taylor amplitude, why don't we return and talk about the most basic amplitude of all, which is the three-particle amplitude. What is the three-particle amplitude in n equals 8? What is the three-particle amplitude in n equals 4? Well, so M3, well, very naively, we should have this piece, right? There's a piece with two minuses and a plus. So there is that piece. There's a piece that looks like delta 8. Lambda 1, eta tilde 1, it's lambda 2, eta tilde 2, it's lambda 3, eta tilde 3, over 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 1. Okay? But that can't be the whole answer. That can't be the whole answer because it only contains the minus, minus, plus amplitudes. It doesn't contain the plus, plus, minus amplitudes. The plus, plus, minus amplitudes would have to be k equals 1. Well, where are the plus plus minus amplitudes going to come from? Well, it's completely obvious. In the other basis, it would have just been exactly the same thing with the lambdas and the lambda tilde, with the lambda goes to lambda tilde, eta goes to eta tilde. So already here we see the sort of basic thing that I was alluding to before. If you just wanted to see n equals 3 supersymmetry, you could write down beautifully there's a separate amplitude for the two different supersymmetric components, and you can just write them down in the same basis, as it were. If you want to see the full n equals 4, it has two pieces that are natural in different bases. Okay? So you can write down the whole answer, but the whole answer is this, plus, I mean, now I just have to take the other answer and Fourier transform it back to this representation. And you can explicitly do this Fourier transform. It's very simple. But I just want to leave it like this just so you see structurally that you're really taking two things that are natural in two different bases, and well, but you have to write the answer in one basis. And so this is the full three-particle amplitude. This is the piece with M3, 2. And this is a piece with M3, 1. Now, I told you a second ago that you can easily prove that all the k equals 1 amplitudes vanish. However, if you go through the argument I just told you, so the argument again is you use supersymmetry to translate two of the eta tildes to the origin. And translating two of the origin, it's obvious that the amplitudes vanish. Okay? Now, the argument for using supersymmetry to translate one of the eta tildes to the origin is completely trivial and generic. But there's a small catch in translating two of the eta tildes to the origin. You have to assume that the angle brackets for lambda tilde 1 and lambda tilde 2 for the guys that you're translating doesn't vanish. Or lambda 1, lambda 2 for the guys that you're translating does not vanish. Otherwise, you can't do the translation. And the three-particle amplitude uniquely is the situation where you run into that obstruction. Either the lambdas vanish or the lambda tilde, even the lambdas are proportional or the lambda tildes are proportional. So for that case, in that case alone, there is a non-trivial k equals 1 amplitude. Okay. So there is a k equals 1 amplitude for three particles. There must be by parity. And it evades this little argument that all the amplitudes vanish for k equals 0 and 1 because the supersymmetry translation that you use to prove that precisely breaks down for the kinematics of three-particle scattering. I could go through this proof, but it won't be very enlightening. So it's a very straightforward proof. But anyway, so you'd be surprised how much headache this caused people in this business. This understanding the proper way to think about this cake was one vertex took a little bit of time. But anyway, this is just this is all there is to it. Okay, so any questions about supersymmetry then? Yes. I wrote this for n equals 4. If we did it for, if I wanted to do it for n equals 8, I just square everything downstairs here and there. And it's delta 16 and not delta 8, yeah. This was just for Yang Mills. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Yes. No. For the three-point function, remember, it's nailed by Poincaré symmetry. Here, it's completely nailed by super Poincaré symmetry. So there's nothing you can do up to an overall constant, non-perturbatively, whatever. This is what it's got to be. No. No. The constant is the constant. I mean, so if you like. So the constant is the coupling constant, and then and every other process is then referred to this one to tell you what the it can't be renormalized. Yeah. By definition. It's, okay. Any questions about this? It's a completely straightforward, simple superspace. The only and it's just life that Q and Q tilde don't commute. So you can make one half manifest, you can make the other half manifest. You can't make both of them manifest at the same time. Next time we'll talk about the formalism that allows you to see the full superconformal and the full Yangian symmetry and all that stuff. But at the moment, explicitly in the amplitudes like this, we can only see half of them at a time. Yes, sir. Yes.
And you have basically this term plus some other one coming.
Yep. Yeah. In fact,
Sorry?
They're all coming. Oh, they're all coming. Yes. They're all coming. They're all coming. Yeah, in fact, it's something which is nice to do because this factor's got to be there in any amplitude. And this factor takes care of, I should have mentioned, the little group scaling is also trivial. Well, not because there's no helicities. The little group scaling is totally uniform, and in fact is completely taken care of by just writing down this factor. Okay, so a nice thing to do, if you like, is to just, you can, if you want to, factor out the whole Park-Taylor superamplitude, and then everything that's left is just a series expansion in the eta tildes. Okay, so that's okay.
Okay, all right.